DW Deutsche Welle Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum. I'm Gabriel Borod in Bonn, Germany. On this week's show, 2018 is very likely to be the year that space tourism kicks off. We'll meet one space entrepreneur right here in Germany. And will our kitchens be changing? We'll meet a Canadian inventor who certainly thinks so. And have you ever walked barefoot with scorpions in the middle of the Namib Desert? If that tickles your fancy, come on along with me on this edition of Spectrum, DW's Science Weekly. ...2018 could be the year that all that Final Frontier stuff flies out the window when it comes to space. Because, let's face it, space tourism is not far off. There are private ventures already on the cusp of producing vehicles that can get to space and back safely. To get a sense of what kind of people are clawing their way into the private space race, we're going to meet one this week. 10 years ago, Robert Burma was an IT security specialist who got an email from Google. It was a call for anyone in the public to enter a competition. The prize, $30 million, for the first person or group who could get to the moon with private money. Most people who received that email simply shrugged it off. But Burma took it seriously and convinced a few of his friends to start working on a prototype with him. Fast forward to 2018, and Burma's got 35 staff members, an annual budget of more than €1 million, and he is well on his way to sending cargo to the moon. Tony Andrews met up with the space entrepreneur in Berlin.
My first encounter with Robert Burma is in his office in suburban Berlin. It's filled with all his past prototypes, like a tiny museum with otherworldly spacecraft sealed behind glass cabinets. Burma is wearing a white button-up shirt and a cheerful expression. He makes such a down-to-earth impression that if you saw him on the street, you probably wouldn't guess that he runs a space company with big ambitions.
What we want to achieve is we want to help bring space exploration to a level where you can actually make a business out of it.
And he's leading by example. By next year, he plans to send a module or spacecraft to the moon and start a kind of space transport business for organizations that want to move objects around above the stratosphere. How he got into this business, that's a little unusual.
I've heard about this crazy challenge that Google put out in 2007, it was late 2007, that they said, the two founders of Google basically said, hey, whoever gets there to the moon privately gets $30 million.
At the time, Burma was an IT security specialist working for the government. Even though he had no experience in space exploration, he decided to enter the challenge. He gathered some friends and started the company known as the Part-Time Scientists, or PT Scientists for short.
Well, what we did is, in the first 5 years, we almost completely did everything we do part-time.
The PT Scientists have since outgrown the Google Prize. They've achieved their ambition of turning their space passion into a functioning business, including a trip to the moon by 2018, without the help of state space agencies.
So what we're currently standing in front of, that's the R2 series, Asimov R2, as we call it, Revision 2. And with back then, we always have an internal name for all our rovers, which are called Asimov, after Isaac Asimov, the book author. And as I mentioned to you, I'm a really big fan of science fiction.
And then he shows me the very first prototype they ever made. It looks a little like a four-wheeler that you ride on the beach, except it has an ET-like head.
We're really quite proud of it, which actually showcased all of the things that we want to have it. So it has a tiltable camera head, so it can turn it camera head 360 degrees, which is important for panoramic images. It can tilt it, you know, up and down. It has a tiltable solar panel, which is also important, means that the solar panel can always get the optimal sun angle.
Besides the prototype archive, there's a sandy area about the size of a large high school gymnasium where some of the testing is done.
And it's basically where we have a simulated lunar landscape. So we put up a lot of, you know, people would call it dirt, but it's actually lava sand.
Burma explains that in developing all this technology, he and his team soon realized that the hope of winning the Google Prize money wasn't enough to finance their ambitions.
In the beginning, you start out with a few 10,000s, And then you immediately realize you need some hundred thousands for prototypes. It gets more and more expensive. That's the problem.
So they started to show their progress to other companies to forge cooperations and pay for more development.
We could actually show to third parties that the technology that we've started out building in our free time actually works in space.
One of their partners now is a German car manufacturer. Turns out knowledge gained in producing a rover that can withstand the harsh sun rays that reach the moon could be useful when producing cars down here.
If you look at spacecrafts, they're always built to keep cool, you know, because the problem is if you're in space, then you don't have air normally, you know, you have a vacuum environment, and air is the number one thing helping you transporting heat. So if you don't have air, then transporting heat can only be done by radiating the heat away. For example, the coating that we use for the rovers have a 98% UV reflectancy. So only 2% of the visual and of the infrared light is actually being converted into heat when it touches the rover. So that's quite good. That's something which is really interesting to understand if you can apply similar concepts to streetcars so that they don't heat up so much in the summertime.
Also, once they get to the moon, the PT scientists want to investigate the Apollo 17 spacecraft, which has been up there since 1972.
The moon is a really harsh environment. You have 100 times the radiation, you have temperature fluctuations of 300 degrees, and you have space weather itself, so it's really interesting to understand what happened to this vehicle.
Verma says that if we can figure out what has happened to the materials after over four decades under brutal lunar conditions, that will help us build future human settlements in space. The PT scientists' most recent venture is to work with Vodafone, a large telecommunications company, to install an LTE or mobile database on the moon, thereby reducing costs of communication. Looking at the business the PT scientists have managed to set up, it's remarkable that Burma is still so young, barely older than 30 in fact. But he says that his youth has been an advantage and not a disadvantage over the years.
The younger you are in the beginning, the more naive you are. And being naive is not such a bad thing. It's, of course, a bad thing in general, but to start out projects like this is not too bad to not have a too detailed understanding of the background.
Youthful naivete is what allows us as human beings to be far bolder than we probably should, given all the pain that progress often costs. Burma and the PT scientists have used it to propel them into a very elite group of space entrepreneurs. Where they will end up is anyone's guess, because in this case, the sky is not the limit.
Like a bit of Stevie Ray Vaughan to bring us back down to earth. Our next report takes us to the kitchen. Perhaps the future of the kitchen. That's what a designer in Canada would have us think. His invention, the Instant Pot, a technically juiced-up pressure cooker equipped with sensors, apps, and Bluetooth, is perhaps what those people who say eating healthier is their New Year's resolution need. Shan Griffiths met with the inventor, Robert Wang, in Ottawa to find out how he is using telecommunications to transform how we make our food.
I meet with Dr. Robert Wang at his office in an Ottawa suburb. He proudly shows me the latest generation, the Ultra Series of Instant Pot. More Star Wars than kitchen appliance.
That's opening, that's closing.
Sounds like R2-D2.
Absolutely. Many people refer the machine to be R2-D2.
Robert Wang has an impeccable resume as a telecoms engineer. After graduating with a PhD in computer science, specializing in artificial intelligence, he spent 25 years in the telecoms and mobile industry, including working at Nortel, a globally renowned Canadian telecommunications company. After a company he founded floundered due to the 2008 credit crunch, he looked to his kitchen for inspiration.
My wife and myself are both working high tech. We also have two young children, very busy working family. So fixing a healthy dinner at home is very difficult. We did lots of takeout, so we thought, let's build a smart cooking appliance which can automate the cooking process and making food, making delicious food consistently.
Something he now does himself at home.
Oh, I do a lot. I do lots of cooking myself. And I have three instant pots at home. I have more than 20 of them in my basement. We have converted to healthy eating. Sweet potato is one of the best food that you can take. Right? Cooking is actually a science. Thankfully, I'm an engineer at heart. I'll pull apart the cooker and then tinker with it.
And sensors were going to be key. He demonstrates what the Instant Pot has in common with the smartphone he is holding in his hand.
A smartphone typically has 10 to 15 sensors. Typical example is that if you are reading this way, when you turn the phone, the text will be reoriented towards the horizontal position for you. Right? If you hold your phone close to your ear, the screen will be turned off. Right? And when the screen is off, when you flip it open, it actually shows the time. Right? That's the smartness of the phone. These are all driven by the sensors in the smartphone. For example, the current generation of Instant Pot has three sensors, pressure sensor, thermal probe at the bottom, and the lid position sensor.
And of course, it's Bluetooth enabled, another carryover from telecoms. But why so many cooking appliances rolled into one?
People live in the urban cities. They have limited concept space. Real estate on the countertop is really, really precious to most people. Right? If you have a multifunctional cooker, can serve as more than one cooking device, then it saves you a lot of room to store the appliance.
But Wang admits even he couldn't avoid the inevitable kitchen disasters.
I burned many food.
The result has been a pressure cooker which could safely make stews, soups, chicken dinners, eggs, rice, cakes, yogurt in record time. The Coe Andersons are a busy working family. Christine and Ken, also both engineers, are parents to baby Ryan and three-year-old Ian. The couple was under pressure to find time to prepare healthy meals.
Give me some pot. Let me plug it in first.
Christine throws vegetables and chicken bones straight from the freezer into the Instant Pot. Very quickly, it's all sizzling nicely. After, Christine adds some water. She puts the lid on.
Close the lid. That's the important part. So it's clever that if I think the lid is not tight, you will remind me.
Wang has ensured no more exploding pressure cookers. And just 25 minutes later, I'm tasting a delicious broth made from scratch. Christine says that broth used to take her 4 hours to make, time she just doesn't have now. She's come to depend on Instant Pot.
This recipe on the Instant Pot, you take maybe after pressure cooking, it will be half an hour, and we can say leave the house and come back and it's all done.
But you can spend time with your kids doing what
you want. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a key. We can just walk away and we don't have to worry about the safety of it. And then now we feel like we don't have to sacrifice the time for cooking and then still give them like nutritious food. So that helps a lot with our life, yeah.
In fact, Wang says he's reimagining all kitchen appliances.
Those devices were invented 70 years ago, invented with the limitation of the technology at the time. Now we have newer technology, newer sensors, microprocessors. We should actually take those legacy devices and reimagine what is the best way to do the cooking with them.
Although he is tight-lipped about what appliances he and his colleagues at Double Insight, his company, are working on, I can't help but wonder about the future of the stove. The Instant Pot seems to be taking over many of its functions.
Will there still be a stove the way we know it?
You see, what people need is not a stove. What people need...
That's controversial.
What people need is delicious food.
DW. Deutsche Welle.
Scorpions have a bad reputation, though often unjustified. Yes, many species are quite venomous, but most scorpions only sting when they feel threatened. And there is still a lot we don't know about these animals. Namibian researcher Martin Hanjaba chose to study scorpions in the Namib Desert. He took a reporter, Brigitte Osterrat, on a tour to find some of those eight-legged predators in the wild. The report is voiced by my colleague, Natalie Muller.
It's a warm night. The full moon is shining brightly, and it feels like we're a million miles from anywhere. Martin Hanjaba is on his way to a dry river valley close to his laboratory in the middle of the Namib Desert.
Here we are right now. We are standing under a tree. It's just an ordinary tree. Most people climb on these trees and they don't really know what's up there. But all over this tree right now, you can't see with your bare eyes, but there are scorpions all over this tree right here.
As many as 100 scorpions could be living on an acacia tree like this one, he says. Finding scorpions at night would be difficult if it wasn't for Martin's secret weapon. And now he pulls it out from a small black case in his pocket.
So now in here I have a UV torch. It's much more, we have a lot more, but this one is much more effective. And we'll just go around the tree where it's a little darker and we'll see if we find some.
Martin points his UV torch or black light at the trunk of the acacia tree.
There's one, for example.
Oh, wow!
So they glow that greenish, bluish color under UV light. Their normal color is brown under normal light, but they will glow greenish blue under UV light because it's a chemical in the exoskeleton that reacts to UV light to create that greenish reflection on the exoskeleton.
This little critter, just a little bigger than my thumbnail, is one of 1,700 known species of scorpion, and they all glow blue-green under black light. It's a mystery why they have the beta-carboline compound that makes their exoskeleton glow, but it certainly makes finding them at night much easier.
There's this one here. Ooh, these two down here, quite close to each other. You see, if you look at this one, the tail is up, and that tail is also up. So these ones are intimidating each other. They are too close to each other. If you look at the other one, the tail is down. It's not disturbed by anyone, but these two are a little too close to each other. So if it gets too close, you just give him a swipe.
Unlike me, Martin is obviously not scared of these riled up arachnids. He's even wearing flip-flops as he walks around in the dark catching scorpions for his research. He even says it's easy.
So they are really clumsy. You can just take them with a little shovel or something and put them in a petri dish or a terrarium. Or you can just grab them with tweezers. The big ones are much more challenging to catch. Some tweezers are not strong enough to hold it. And they also spray venom. If you grab the tail and it feels completely cornered, it can squirt like, just like a spitting cobra does.
We head back to the research station, to Martin's lab filled with terrariums scattered around the room. In one of them, a yellow-brown coloured scorpion is busy digging in the sand.
So this is a really small scorpion. It's called Opis ophthalmis holmii. They construct their burrows in the dunes. We found that some of the burrows can go up to 3 meters, really deep, deep burrows underground, formed by such little creatures.
They are not venomous, Martin adds. If they sting, it doesn't kill you, so it's easy to do research with them. But that's certainly not true for all species.
We had two big black ones called Parabusus villosus, and they are notorious in this area. They are known to be the most dangerous scorpion here. They are much bigger, obviously, can go up to 200 millimeters. If you get stung by that one, then it's a problem. But I'll tell you that almost every scorpion researcher has been stung by one of those dangerous scorpions at one point, and I'm one of them. But I guess we are just lucky.
Martine got what is known as a dry sting. The scorpion didn't inject any venom.
But the pain is really excruciating. So when a scorpion stings you, there's only two outcomes. It either gives you a full dose of venom or it doesn't. And usually if you're just handling it and it feels, you know, I don't want to be handled, it just gives you a swipe. But there's always one or two that are more aggressive than the other, so they have different personalities. If some of them are aggressive, they can give you a full dose just because they can, especially young ones. We all know that young animals like showing off.
Despite the very real danger, Martin is clearly happy to work with scorpions. He even looks at his work as a kind of mission. The world should know more about these creatures, he says, and appreciate them. And indeed, scorpions might be more important for our ecosystems than we know. Martin is testing a hypothesis here that scorpion burrows help aerate the soil and help with fertilisation. So, above all, he stresses that people have no right to kill them off just because they might be venomous. But the question remains, especially if you live here in the Namib Desert, what do you do if you see a scorpion in your house?
You just need to treat them with respect. Don't handle them with your bare hands. That's something else. You are looking for trouble. Just move them out of the way. I'll sweep them outside and they'll find their way somewhere else.
For many tourists visiting South Africa, the adrenaline rush of coming face to face with the notorious great white shark is top of their agenda. But tour operators running cage diving expeditions are worried. The powerful predators are becoming scarce on South Africa's west coast. Scientists fear the local great white shark population might be dying out. Jan-Philippe Schluter took to the shark-infested waters to find out more. His report is voiced by Ruby Russell.
We're on subtropical South Africa's west coast, but the Atlantic waters here off Gans Bay never exceed a nippy 14 degrees Celsius.
Oh, okay.
The tour boat's seven passengers are well protected in neoprene dive suits, but with this much adrenaline, who'd feel the chill anyway? Sitting in a steel cage suspended at the water's surface, they're about to have their first encounter with a great white shark.
So nervous.
Too nervous.
Yeah.
Oh.
Among them is Niklas, a 26-year-old student from Cologne in Germany.
I'm fascinated by sharks. Always have been, actually. So I thought, since I'm here in the area, I've got to do this.
For now, the cage divers sit and wait, staring into the water. A stinking brew of fish heads, chopped sardines and fish oil is poured overboard to attract the sharks. But whether the stars of the show turn up or not is down to them, says marine biologist Sara Andriotti with a grin. She's been researching great whites here at Gans Bay for 7 years now.
They all have different personalities. Some of them get very skittish by the situation, they just leave. Some of them stick around, and these are the ones we can play with. We are making them waste a little bit of time.
Suddenly, the command comes. Put your goggles on, take a deep breath, and dive. And here it is. A great white, nearly 4 meters long, rushes toward the boat, turns elegantly at the last moment, and glides right past the cage, eyeing the shark watchers and flashing sharp triangular teeth.
Remember, the shark's not going to stop to pose for pictures. Good.
It's the first of four of the otherworldly giants to make an appearance today. A good turnout by current standards, tour operator Michael Rutzen says with regret.
Before, I think the average that we saw in a day is 7 or 8, and the numbers of sightings have definitely decreased.
46-year-old Rutzen is famous in South Africa as the Shark Man. He spent more time freediving around great whites than anyone, that is, without the safety of the cage. Celebs like Brad Pitt, Leonardo DiCaprio and Prince Harry have all made the journey to dive with him. Rutzen also invests in shark research. Among other things, he's co-financed a population study by Sara Andreotti from Stellenbosch University. The results are worrying. According to Andreotti, the number of great whites off the South African coast has fallen. Her research confirms what Rutzen and his crew observe daily.
Sara's work are proving what we're seeing in the field.
We could estimate that we have between 300 and 500 white sharks left around the coastline. What we are worried about is if nothing changes in the pattern we are seeing now, we might see them going.
According to Andreotti, humans are to blame for the sharks' decline. It's down to a combination of pollution, illegal hunting, overfishing of the shark's prey, and badly designed shark nets, which are meant to protect swimmers but can ensnare the animals and kill them. If great whites died out here, there would be terrible consequences for the whole food chain, Andreotti says.
White sharks are apex predators. They are keeping balance in the whole ecosystem. Without these species to balance this equilibrium, think about Cape Fur seals. If we won't have apex predators to eat Cape Fur seals, the seals population is going to increase terribly, dramatically, and they are going to need a lot of fishes to sustain themselves.
Andreotti's study is not without controversy. Marine biologist Alison Koch is at the newly renovated Shark Spotters office at Muizenberg Beach near Cape Town. Shark Spotters keeps watch over several beaches in the area. It's their job to warn surfers when the feared predators are nearby. Koch and her colleagues from the University of Cape Town have reviewed Andreotti's Gans Bay study and question its results.
Previous estimates were between 1 and 2,000 animals, but 500 is a very, very low number, and we just have technical problems with this particular number, and we believe it represents doesn't represent the entire population.
Still, the scientists agree on one thing. Whether there are 500 great whites off this coast or more than 1,000, they are an endangered species and need greater protection. Andreotti and Rutzen wanted the shark recategorised from endangered to threatened with extinction at the recent World Wildlife Conservation Conference in Johannesburg. But a promotion wasn't on the agenda.
It is my belief that they should have done that, and it's also my belief that if they don't get protection for these animals in the nearby future, white shark cage diving will cease to exist within South African borders.
The loss of these sharks would be a disaster for the delicate ecosystem here. For the human population of Gans Bay, a fishing village and mecca for cage diving, it would also be a huge economic blow. Numerous bed and breakfasts, restaurants and 8 tour operators rely on the business. Without the sharks, plenty of locals would be out of a job. Michael Rutzen's boat bobs gently on the waves as Niklas, the German tourist, climbs out of the cage with a broad grin on his face. He's just been eye to eye with a great white shark, its jaws just centimetres from his face. It's an experience he won't forget anytime soon.
It was really spectacular to see the sharks from so close up, not least because of their huge size. It was majestic.
And that is all the time we have for this week. I sincerely hope you've been informed or at least interested by this edition of Spectrum. You can download the program at dw.com/spectrum. And always, if you've got a comment or a story idea you want us to hear about, please tweet us or get in touch on Facebook or send an email at spectrum@dw.com. For me, Gabriel Borud, our sound tech, Michael Springer, and all of us here at DW, have a wonderful week ahead.